Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi.
Siri. Welcome to High Theory.
In this podcast, we get high on the substance of theory. I'm Kim Adams.
And I'm Sharunik Boshu.
We are two tired academics trying to save critique from itself.
Hello and welcome to High Theory. Today we are talking about Global Asia with Cheryl Narumi.
Naruse.
Cheryl, before we begin talking about your book and your work, can we have you introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. My name is Cheryl Narumi Naruse. I'm an assistant professor of English and the Andrew W. Mellon Assistant Professor of the Humanities at Tulane University, where I teach contemporary Anglophone literatures and cultures, especially those from Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands, diasporic Asian and Asian American literature, and postcolonial theory.
Thank you so much for coming to High Theory and talking to us about Global Asia, which is the title, well, part of the title of your upcoming book, Becoming Global Asia, Contemporary Genres of Postcolonial Capitalism in Singapore. Yes. But before we talk about the book, Cheryl, what the heck is Global Asia?
So in my book, I'm thinking about how Singapore has transformed its reputation as a draconian, authoritative state to one that is desirable, cool, and admirable. You know, and I think you can observe this in a number of different ways these days. Singapore is featured on television shows, Hollywood, Bollywood, travel shows. It's in the New York Times. You also see this in political commentary. Policymakers from both the global south and the global north are often citing Singapore as a model for economic development. And I mean, I guess anecdotally speaking, I would say, like, I've also noticed a shift of this shift in the perception of Singapore over the last 20 years I've lived in the United States. Like, when I first moved here, I'd get these questions about whether I've ever been caned before or whether I've ever chewed gum. And I'd also get questions about, like, whether I'd ever met a white person before or if there was, like, running water in Singapore. These days, I tend to get comments that are more like, oh my gosh, I love Singapore, or I wish I could visit one day, it looks so cool, or my cousin who works in finance, like, lives in Singapore and thinks it's the best. Right. You know, so there's been, like, a real, like, change over time. So Global Asia is a way for me to name that transformation in the perception of Singapore as an alluring Asian setting for capitalist flourishing. And I do mean to offer the term in a broad way because there's just, like, a number of different sites in Singapore, in Asia that fashion themselves in a similar way. But in the context of Singapore, though, Global Asia is the literal name of the strategy that was used by Singapore's Economic Development Board in the 2000s when the transformation was beginning. So my usage of Global Asia is a historical gesture and one that's helping me pin down, like, my object of study.
Right.
And so the book is an attempt to understand what Global Asia is, what its story of power is, what its broader cultural and political effects are.
Right.
And I'm looking at an archive of literary and cultural productions, including ones by the Singaporean state, to study Global Asia. I mean, that choice of archive has to do with my argument that Singapore is Global Asia. You just can't understand it only as, like, some kind of perfected outcome of state rule or social engineering. And instead, we really have to understand it as, like, an aestheticized and a transnationalized narrative that exceeds Singapore itself. And one that we really have to understand with respect to the cultural history, what I'm describing of as postcolonial capitalism.
Right.
And, you know, so in other words, I'm, like, really thinking about Global Asia as a postcolonial formation and an important one because, like, Singapore is a site that tends to elide our attention in postcolonial studies. My point isn't that we need to be inclusive of Singapore just for the sake of.
Right.
I mean, I'm just trying to point out here that we have to understand that Singapore, like, Singapore's cultural capital and soft power as Global Asia, and especially because it's emerging as a site of, like, imperial desire. It's a post-colonial model, and it's also an economic wedge that's wielded against the Global South.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just think, like, these are all things that post-colonial theory, like, really needs to grapple with.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, so I guess like this is a follow-up question, and especially because this is somewhat pertains to the field that we both kind of work on, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the cultural life of economic progress, so to speak. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you can, like, you talked about how the way in which the change of what Singapore is culturally speaking all over the world during, you know, your own life. I'm mm-hmm. also wondering if you can kind of situate that with respect to, you know, other Southeast Asian economies which have gone through similar kind of cultural transitions.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, I think this comes back to like sort of like this idea that like global Asia like exists in many, like there's many examples of them, you know. And I mean, I think, you know, Korea certainly has like this sort of soft power when you're thinking about like the influence of like their media systems and technology. I mean, sorry, like their acting, K-pop, you know, K-dramas, Samsung, all those different things, kind of what like Japan used to be with Sony. But you also have sites like, you know, India and like New India Discourse. And, you know, everyone has like their sort of way of branding themselves to be a sort of site of capitalist flourishing. I mean, I think the Philippines also does this, but in a very different manner when it comes to, say, like retirement tourism and that sort of thing. But just sort of trying to present each of these Asian sites as somehow like, yeah, like, I mean, a place where one can, like, live their best lives in terms of, like, economic development.
You know, diving very concertedly into your book, my next question is, how do we use, or how do you use global Asia? And I know that you have already started answering this question, but I'm kind of mainly asking you about, like, you know, who your interlocutors are, like, how you're situating yourself in...
Absolutely.
Like,
I mean, you know, I actually think the question is like just on a lot of people's minds right now, because the term is getting used across a lot of different academic institutional contexts, see in university programs, conference streams, journals, and so on. And, you know, as someone like perhaps you know this too, as someone that works in post-colonial studies, like it feels a little like how the term global Anglophone emerged. Like one day it just seemed to be everywhere, right, and everyone right. seemed to have a different understanding of it, you know. And so I guess, like, you know, for me, I'd want to say that, like, it's we have to start off splicing. It's a flexible term that has a lot of different uses beyond what appears in my book. For me, it's about naming cultural phenomenon as a point of departure for understanding post-colonial capitalism. But more broadly across speaking across the academy, you see global Asia being used to, I mean, I think the investment here is like really trying to change the conditions of knowledge production about Asia. And for some, that can describe a critical approach that breaks free of East-West binarisms. In other cases, such as the case with Tina Chen's work at the Global Asia Institute at Penn State, we see a critical approach that's like intersecting the sub-disciplines of Asian, Asian diasporic, and Asian American studies. But, you know, the term is also used by like a number of corporations. Like, I mean, if you just Google Global Asia, like, you know, there's like a million variations of like limited or corporate namings of Global Asia. So, I mean, there it's a sort of branding technique right. to mark how the that particular business is ready for the global economy. So, I mean, I think what all these usages have in common, though, is that they really want to deploy the idea that Asia is a connected place and that Asia has to be understood within the dynamics of global connection. And, you know, what those ideas are being deployed in service of is like really where we see the differences in usage. And so, I mean, I guess the short answer to your question, and maybe this is a cop-out, is that the term is really open to interpretation in terms of its usage. It's a term that generates a lot of possible approaches, and it's a term that can also bring together a lot of different ideas.
Right. Do you think, I mean, this is a fake question that might be misleading.
I love fake questions.
but what I'm mainly kind of, so at presently, you know, I'm really interested in, you talked about the cultural mm-hmm. text produced by the Singaporean government and also mm-hmm. how it kind of extends the soft power. I'm wondering, do you, like, how would you kind of diagnose the difference between, let's say, like a culture of efficiency that was once promoted during like the rise of this economy and, you know, the brand Global Asia now, which is, again, like this is, there's a kind of duration between those two, right? So this
yeah,
is something.
Yeah, I mean, I think this comes back to like my sort of thinking around post-colonial capitalism. But, you know, I do want to see that, like, for me, like the newness of global Asia is like, even though it might like appear that way, but it's actually like a cultural and political veneer that requires deeper historicization. And so I don't want to think about global Asia's newness as like now Singapore is trying to be like a totally different place with different governance, you know?
Right.
I think that, you know, those sort of authoritarian tendencies in Singapore, like absolutely still exist, right? I mean, like this isn't trying, I don't want to make an argument that like Singapore doesn't have like, you know, the death penalty and issues of censorship, so on and so forth, you know, like all those things are absolutely still at work. And like, they're sort of marking this kind of historical moment, like earlier in its nation formation. But I guess I am thinking about like how global Asia is like both working within that history and also kind of obscuring it as well. I mean, in service of like capital accumulation.
Right. Right. Okay. This is a good time to pivot to, I think, my final question, which is, and you knew this was coming. So how will global Asia save
this? This was a hard question, but you know, like, I mean, I think ultimately it was for me, like, what I hope global Asia will do is help us think more carefully about the role of post-coloniality in the production of global capitalism. You know, it's like really tempting, I think, as some have, to explain phenomena like global Asia as an example of neoliberalism at work. And to me, like this really misses out on some of the nuances of how capitalism works or operates in post-colonial contexts, which is say, I mean, like to give a definition of post-colonial capitalism, it's like I'm thinking about how capitalist cultures are motivated, rationalized, strategized through a consciousness of colonialism and racial capitalism, both past and present. And so I think post-colonial capitalism offers global Asia a different kind of historical gloss rather than neoliberalism by situating it within the trajectory of decolonizing nationalisms. And, you know, I think that having a critical understanding of capitalism and to hopefully one day save the world from capitalism means that we actually have to think through these historical and contextual particularities.
Before we end this episode, and because, you know, I haven't gotten my hands on the book yet, so I'm really curious as to what are some of the texts that you're reading and if you can kind of pick out your favorites.
I have so many. let me see. I mean, I feel like the chapter that people are going to probably look at the most because of its popularity, I do read the novel Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. I talk about the movie a little bit in the conclusion. I definitely spend more time on the novel. And I mean, in that chapter, what do I say about it? I mean, I'm thinking there about like how the desire for Singapore sort of operates in the context of U.S. empire decline and or just like a sort of a fear of economic decline, too. And so and how we need to sort of read those dynamics, those sort of neo-Orientalist dynamics within a reconfiguration of gender relations. Another chapter. So each of the chapters is really focused on like different like subgenres. And for me, like the genre question is like all of these genres emerge around the time of Singapore's transformation, which is after the 1997 Asian financial crisis. And so there I'm sort of things like, well, you know, why is it like these genres are emerging at this time? Like, what are they sort of remarking about on the moment? So on and so forth. I work with this novel, Hui Hui Tan's Mammon Ink, which is about a person, a Singaporean woman who's newly graduated, and she goes to work for the largest corporation in the world. I mean, so it sort of reads as a sort of comment on like corporate labor or neoliberalism, but my reading there is sort of thinking through more like how the sort of conditions of work need to be understood with respect to sort of post-colonial independence movements in Singapore, and not just sort of seen as like just corporate ideology. I think my favorite text that I work with is Jeremy Tiang's It Never Rains on National Day, which is a collection of short stories about diasporic Singaporeans. that book. I'm like, it's a little hard to contextualize my reading of it, but it's like, I kind of see it as like a I read it as a sort of critique of some of the Singaporean state's representations of diasporic Singaporeans and how that's kind of been done in the past couple of years. But I think you were asking me a question about like the Singaporean state texts, and a lot of my literary texts that I'm examining, I'm reading them alongside I have a booklet produced by the Singaporean state that's like aimed at like recruiting Singaporeans to return back home. I'm looking at like a newspaper series that like features Singaporeans living abroad, and in the news, in the context of Singapore, like all the newspapers are state controlled. So I see that as a state text. I'm also looking at like, you know, policies and speeches and just sort of the general rhetoric, you know, the way that global age is being talked about. So, yeah.
That sounds super exciting, Cheryl, and I can't wait to read the book. Thank you so much for coming to High Theory and talking to us about global Asia and how the term is finding.
Thank you
life
for
right
having
now.
Me.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to High Theory.
If you like our podcast, please review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast fix.
Sharnik Bosu and Nathan Kim manage our social media presence.
Julia Irion Martins edits our transcripts, and Owen Quinn composes our theme music.
You can also find us at hightheory.net. We hope you have a highly theoretical day.